Indeed, it's a joy for Sister Henriette and I to be here with you, and we've had the privilege of being at many of the Memorial Day weekend and New Year's convention, and this is actually our first time at one of your Sunday meetings or four Sunday conventions, and so we're glad to once again see all of you and to renew our fellowship. We'd like to first bring the warm Christian love of your brethren in Detroit who voted last Sunday to send their special love to you, and they warmly invite you to the Detroit Prememorial Convention on April 15, 16, and 17 of next year. So we hope you can all come, and I'm sure the brethren will be sending programs out as in a couple of weeks. Today in Detroit, there's a joint meeting between the Detroit class and the Metropolitan Detroit brethren. And, of course, your brother Russ Martin is serving there, and also brother David Duran. So they're enjoying rich blessings today as well. The names Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, at first, for some of us, may not seem so familiar. But actually, you know these three individuals, and you may know them by another name. Each of them were heroes of faith who lived during Old Testament times. They were each Hebrew. And this morning, we'd like to review some of the lessons of their life, and I'm sure it'll be a review of things you've considered in the past. It was at the time of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. He had besieged Jerusalem and stolen the vessels from the temple. And we find in Daniel, the first chapter, verse 3, where Nebuchadnezzar speaks unto the master of his eunuchs, and he says to them, and this is how it reads in the Rotherham, that the master of Nebuchadnezzar's eunuchs should bring in of the sons of Israel, even of the royal seed and of the nobles. That's how it reads in the Rotherham. And that's actually a fulfillment of a prophecy that God gave to Hezekiah in 2 Kings, the 20th chapter, verses 17 and 18. And there, in 2 Kings 20, 17 and 18, God said to Hezekiah that thy sons that shall issue from thee shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar set certain criteria to select some of the children of Israel who were taken captive. And in Daniel, the first chapter, verse 4, this was Nebuchadnezzar's criteria. Again, reading from the Rotherham. Youths, in whom was no blemish, but comely of countenance, and skillful in all wisdom, and possessed of knowledge, and able to impart instruction, and who had vigor in them to stand in the palace of the king, that they should be taught the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. Reprint 3630 suggests that they were teenagers who were selected from the tribe of Judah, around 16 years old. They were handsome, strong, intelligent men. Young men who would be instructed in the language and given responsibility. These young youths from the tribe of Judah were given a test that came upon them. And verse 5 says, and the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. So we find these youths who were selected because of their strength and their good looks and their intelligence, that they were to enter a 3-year training program. then they would be tested at the end of 3 years. You notice how King Nebuchadnezzar, he was no dummy. Who did he pick? He picked the best and the brightest from Israel. And that did two things for King Nebuchadnezzar. First, it directly helped the Babylonians run their own government by having such qualified individuals. And secondly, it would have depleted the Israelites of their best and their brightest people. And it would reduce, therefore, the risk of the Jews revolting against the Babylonians. Several years ago, some of the brethren had the opportunity after the international convention to go by bus and for a week after the convention visit some of the ecclesias in Poland and to see some of the things in Poland, and one of those was Auschwitz. And the guide, when he led us through that facility, mentioned when the Jews who were brought there by boxcar, they would line up the Jews and they would ask them, is anyone a doctor? Is anyone a blacksmith? Those who had skills. And of course, those who had the skills, immediately they raised their hand, thinking that perhaps they would be spared some of the harshness. But the Nazis actually selected those who were skillful. They were the first to be sent to the gas chambers because they would be the ones to create the most havoc for the Nazis. But Nebuchadnezzar didn't do that. He selected the best and the brightest from Judah. Verse 6 says in Daniel 1, now among them, these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so here we meet the individuals for our lesson this morning. In verse 7, we find the ruler or prince of the eunuchs changes their names. To Daniel, he gave the name Belshazzar, which if you look in the Companion Bible, which of course is a King James version, but it has extensive footnotes on each of the verses, it mentions that Belshazzar meant protect thou, O Bel. And Bel was a Babylonian false god. Hananiah was given the name Shadrach, which meant command of Iku, the moon god. Mishael was given the name Meshach, which meant who is as Iku. And Azariah was given the name Abednego, which meant servant or worshiper of Nego. Why did the ruler of the eunuchs change the names of the youths from Judah? It was to try to get these young, impressionable youths to forget about their heritage, about their Jewish past, and to think and become as Babylonians. And these Babylonian names perhaps were a constant reminder of their servitude to Babylon. And so we see that the names Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were really false names, or we would say made-up names. In verse 8, again from the Rotherham, but Daniel laid it upon his heart. The King James says, purposed. In other words, he made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the delicacies of the king, nor with the wine which he drank. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah did the same. And so Daniel requested from the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Why did these four Hebrew youths refuse to eat the king's food and drink his drink? Perhaps two reasons. First, it's been suggested that the king's food would have first been offered up to the Babylonian false gods. And if so, then eating that food could be seen as really endorsing or agreeing with those false gods. Because you'll notice Daniel said that he did not want to defile himself. And the word defile in verse 8 is from Strong's 1351, and it means to soil or to desecrate. Elsewhere, in the Old Testament, it's been translated as pollute or stain. The little flock strives to not defile the robe of righteousness given to them. Revelation 3, verse 4, Revelation 3, 4, speaks of a few who have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with Christ in white, for they are worthy. James 1:27 says, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. A second reason the four Hebrews would have refused to eat the king's food, we have to remember that the Babylonians at that time were the superpower of the ancient world. And you can imagine when Nebuchadnezzar ate, we could picture that as almost an all-you-could-eat food buffet of probably almost any delicacy that man ate at that time. But we also know under the law in Leviticus, the 11th chapter, verses 4 to 12, that the Hebrews were told by God that there were certain foods they were not to eat because they were considered unclean. And it was things listed in Leviticus, the 11th chapter, such as eagles, vultures, owls, swans, the swine or pigs, and from the sea, if it didn't have fins or scales, they weren't to eat it. It was unclean. And so we can see that by not eating the king's food, the four Hebrews were sure to not violate the Jewish law. They could be careful along those lines. In Daniel, the first chapter, verse 10, the prince of the eunuchs doesn't grant Daniel's request. He refuses to not let them change their diet because he fears for his own life, saying at the end of verse 10, then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. And certainly he would have spoken in a literal sense. But Daniel doesn't give up. In verse 11, we see he asks Melzar, who was appointed by the prince of the eunuchs to watch over these four Hebrews. And Daniel says to him in verse 12, prove or test thy servants 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. And after 10 days, compare our appearance with those who ate the king's food. And then at the end of 10 days, compare the appearances, and then you judge accordingly. The word pulse comes from Strong's 2235, and it's something sown in the ground like a vegetable. In 2 Samuel, the 17th chapter, verses 27 to 29, pulse was listed along with wheat, barley, flour, corn, beans, lentils, which were given to David and the people because they were hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Reprint 3630 suggests that pulse was something like peas or beans. It was a vegetable. We find in verse 14 of Daniel, the first chapter, Melzar agrees, and so he proves Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah for 10 days. And in verse 15, you recall how after 10 days, their appearance was fairer and fatter than the rest of the youths who were eating the king's food. And so we find that Melzar takes away their portion of the king's food in verse 16, and he gives them pulse to eat, and they drink water. If we think about it, here we had four Hebrew youths around 16 years of age. They were selected from the rest of the tribe of Judah who were taken captive to be part of this special elite, so to speak, training program for the king. They were good-looking young men. They were intelligent. They were strong. We would say they had a lot of, from the the earthly standpoint, a lot of things in their favor. But if these four Hebrews had a shallow character, they might have allowed the fact that they were fairly good-looking or not too or pretty intelligent, that to think that maybe that was why they were selected, because of just those qualities they had. And so they might have misled themselves into thinking, well, they should just follow along. They were selected anyways as a captive people to just follow along with the king's food and the drink, to fit in, as it were, or as sometimes it said, when in Rome, do as the Romans. But they did not do that, did they? Why? Well, two reasons. And primarily it was their parents were godly people. And they raised their sons to be godly. One indication of this is the names they gave to each of their sons. Each Hebrew name meant something. The name Daniel, if you look that up in Strong's, comes from 1840, and it means God is my judge. God is my judge. There was a brother many years ago, Brother Steve Sarasi, and one of the lessons he used to bring out in his talks is, if we really want to understand a word in the Hebrew or the Greek, to not only look it up in Strong's, but when you look up the definition, sometimes it says see also or compare with another number. And we learn even deeper if we go further and look at the prefix and the suffix of the word and what those meanings are, and we kind of get a deeper appreciation of the definition. And so in the case of Daniel, the prefix is Dan, and that means judge, and the suffix is E-L, or L, as in God. So God is my judge. The name Hananiah in Strong's is 2608, and it means God is gracious. And there it comes from two words, and the other word is 2603, and it means to bend or stoop down in kindness to an inferior. And the other word is Strong's 3050, Jah, J-A-H, the Lord. And so you can see how God is gracious, how God is bending down in kindness to mankind. The name Mishael comes from Strong's 4332 and means godlike. And Azariah comes from Strong's 838 and it means God is a helper. And there, it comes, that Hebrew word comes from two other Hebrew words, one of which is 5826, and it means to surround or protect or aid. And the other word is again 3050, Jah, the Lord. God is my helper. So we can picture that these four Hebrews, given these special names to think about the Lord as they grew up, that would have been a remembrance to them. And in fact, if there's one little lesson, if you can only remember one thing in this study, let us try to remember the true Hebrew names of the ones in our lesson today, not the Babylonian false names, even though those are a little more well-known. And secondly, we know these four didn't have a shallow character because of the decisions they demonstrated, the character they had. Growing up, perhaps their parents taught them the reason why the Jewish nation was taken captive by the Babylonians, because they had been disobedient to God. And perhaps they were taught that they should specially resolve, even though Israel had been taken captive and was being punished for that, that they should still be faithful to the Lord and what they were supposed to do. We don't know how many other youths were in this training program, but it's possible that the others in the group who continued to eat the king's food and drink would have looked down upon these four Hebrews on the side eating their simple meal every day of pulse and water. They might have considered these four to be kind of oddballs, foolish, maybe even dumb, to pick such a bland diet when here they could have such a variety of the king's food every day. If that was the case, then Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah may have been, we would say today, ostracized by the rest of the youths in the program. If so, it would have been, you can imagine, a daily persecution. At every mealtime of every day, this would come up. There was no escaping it. And it would be a period of 3 years. That's 1,095 days of day after day persecution. The four Hebrews daily denied themselves these delicacies of the king and instead chose to follow what God instructed Israel to do. Jesus tells us in Luke 9:23, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." And you recall the word deny that Jesus used means to deny utterly or completely. Titus 2, verse 11 and 12, Titus 2, 11 and 12 says, speaks of the grace of God, which teaches us that we should deny ungodliness and worldly lusts, and instead live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. In Daniel 1:17, it says, "And as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had discernment in all visions and dreams." And we find at the end of the 3 years, in verse 19, when King Nebuchadnezzar tests each of these youths that were being trained, that in any matter of wisdom and discernment, there was no one found like these four Hebrews. In fact, it says that he found them 10 times better than the ones that Nebuchadnezzar had, all his sacred scribes and magicians. That's mentioned in verse 20. Reprint 2493 mentions that this skill and knowledge of the four Hebrews was not 100% just a pure miracle by God, but it was the Lord working with these four Hebrews, and also the fact that these four youths had practiced self-denial, and they had demonstrated character with the decisions they had made. And so developed a mental discipline that would have applied to, as they studied the language and the different rules and the way the Babylonians ran their government. So they would have been found to be superior, but for sure the Lord would have helped them to be so far superior than the rest. A little lesson for us. May we continue to realize the importance of having strong, righteous wills, even when it's a little thing in our life. As it says in Luke 16:10, "He who is faithful in things that are least may be expected to be found faithful also in things that are greater." When we think of the three Hebrews, I'm sure your minds have already raced to the account when their lives were in jeopardy in the burning fiery furnace. But we'd like to review how their lives were in jeopardy even before that in Daniel the second chapter. And you recall in Daniel the second chapter, we'd like to read verse 1. "And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep break from him." And so you recall this dream, and to Nebuchadnezzar, it was probably like a nightmare. He woke up so suddenly. And you recall in verse 2, he commands and calls the magicians and astrologers and sorcerers and the Chaldeans to tell him his dream. And they arrive before him, and they answer back in verse 4 that, "Tell us the dream and we'll give you the interpretation." And of course, you recall, there was just one little problem. Nebuchadnezzar couldn't remember his dream. And so we have in the next several verses this dialogue back and forth between Nebuchadnezzar and his magicians and astrologers. And they want to know what the dream is to give him some story, and he can't remember anything. And Nebuchadnezzar's not known for his patience. So we find, finally, in verse 12, it says that Nebuchadnezzar was angry and so furious that he commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And it says in verse 13, the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. And so here we see how the four Hebrews, their lives were in jeopardy here relative to this dream. In verse 16, Daniel requests an appointment with King Nebuchadnezzar to tell him the dream and its interpretation. What a faith Daniel had. He had not even that information yet, but he was going to pray to the Lord to help in this matter. And we find in verse 17, after Daniel gets the appointment scheduled, that Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they should desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And so they do pray to the Lord, and we find in verse 19 that during the night the vision is revealed to Daniel. And Daniel immediately blesses and prays to the Heavenly Father. And he says in verse 20 at the end that wisdom and might are God's. And he says in verse 21 how it's he, referring to God, changes the times and the seasons. And God removeth kings and setteth up kings. And God giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. Later in verse 26, when Daniel comes before King Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar asks him, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation? In Daniel's reply in verse 27 and 28, he says, no, it's not me, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets. Daniel gave all the credit to the Heavenly Father. And so you recall from your past studies, I'm sure, how later on in the second chapter of Daniel, Daniel explains the dream and the interpretation, how God was going to permit the times of the Gentiles, and that the image had a head of gold was a picture of Babylon, and the breast and arms of silver a picture of Medo-Persia, and the belly and thighs of brass picturing the Greek Empire, and the legs of iron, picturing Rome, and so forth, and the interpretation of that, and how after the times of the Gentiles, that God was going to set up a kingdom which would never be destroyed, which would stand forever. At the end of the interpretation, we find later on in Daniel, the second chapter, in verse 46, Nebuchadnezzar falls before Daniel, and he worships and he proclaims to Daniel that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings. And in verse 48, Nebuchadnezzar made Daniel a great man. He gave him great gifts. He made him ruler over Babylon and over the wise men of Babylon. And you recall how in verse 49, Daniel didn't forget those three faithful companions who prayed with him. And so he requested, and they were set up over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Going on to Daniel, the third chapter, and we don't have a an exact date of when Daniel, the third chapter, occurred. Reprint 2494 suggests that perhaps chapter 3 occurred around 20 years after the first chapter of Daniel. Daniel 3, verse 1 says, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. It seems that Nebuchadnezzar may have taken a literal interpretation of the dream of this head of gold. We don't know exactly what the image was, but it's quite possible that it was an image of a head of gold, perhaps his head covered with gold. From the dimensions given in this first verse, it's been suggested that the height of the image would have been around 90 feet tall. And if that's true, it would have been as tall as the Statue of Liberty in New York, just as kind of a reference. In verse 2, we find that Nebuchadnezzar gathers together all his government people to come to a dedication of the image. And we find in verses 5 and 6 that they were instructed when they heard the sound of the musical instruments, they were to immediately fall down and worship the golden image. And the penalty for not falling down and worshiping was the same hour being thrown into the fiery furnace, a lesson you well know for many years. So we find that in verse 7, the music sounds. It says, therefore, at the time when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. All the people fell down, except for 3. And we find that this was noticed, and there were certain Chaldeans who came to King Nebuchadnezzar, telling him in verse 12 that there were certain Jews whom he had set up over the affairs of the province of Babylon, and he mentions their Babylonian names, that they did not regard the instruction that was given. And we find in verse 13 that Nebuchadnezzar is angry and in a rage, and he commands them to bring the 3 Hebrews before him. And in verse 14, he asks them, is it true? Can this be true, that you do not serve my gods nor worship the golden image which I've set up? He doesn't even wait for an answer. He's so angry. He says in verse 15, he gives them another chance that when they hear the music, if they fall down and worship, things will be well. But if not, they would be cast the same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And at the end of verse 15, he concludes by saying, and if they don't obey, and who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? We can detect the arrogance in which he must have said those words. The 3 Hebrews replied, and this is verses 16 through 18 from the NIV, saying, they replied to Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Can you think about it? These 3 Hebrews before the leader of the superpower of that ancient world disobeying his command. In reprint 2495, it mentions the point that the 3 Hebrews did not try and retaliate against Nebuchadnezzar. They didn't preach that God would have vengeance against Nebuchadnezzar. They didn't try and convert Nebuchadnezzar. It wasn't the due time. They simply replied to the king that they were not going to bow down and worship the golden image. Their minds were made up. Because it was clear in their mind what the decision was, because to bow down to the golden image would have violated several of the Ten Commandments given to the Hebrews. The three Hebrews had faith that if God chose, he would deliver them. And they had faith that if God decided not, they were still going to remain faithful even unto death. In verse 19, we have the reaction of Nebuchadnezzar. He's just wound up even further, full of fury. And he commands that the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than normal. If this furnace was the one used to melt the gold for the golden image, the scientists say that pure gold melts at around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And so you can imagine when they were commanded to heat it 7 times hotter than normal, this was a furnace that was quite literally ready to explode at any moment. In verse 20, Nebuchadnezzar commands the most mighty men in his army to bind the three Hebrews and to cast them into the fiery furnace. And so Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were led away, bound, to be thrown into the fiery furnace. If you've ever worked in or even visited a foundry or a steel mill or even something like a glass factory, you would recall the roar of the furnaces that are used to melt the materials. And if you've ever walked, even you don't even have to be close to the furnace, if you're even any proximity to it, you would feel the heat waves coming off the furnace. And so Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they would have heard the roar as the furnace was being heated 7 times hotter than normal as they were standing there bound. And as they were led to the furnace, they would feel that heat coming from the furnace on the face of their skin. And yet they remained faithful, and they were steadfast to the end. Revelation 2:10, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. We find in verse 22 that the furnace was so hot, the mighty army men who bound and threw the three Hebrews into the fire, they were destroyed themselves. And then we have from verses 24 and 25 that Nebuchadnezzar notices after the Hebrews are thrown in the fire, he sees that they're not bound. They're loosed, walking in the midst of the fire. The fire had released them from bondage. And there was a fourth being or image of a being with them in the fiery furnace. And perhaps it was an angel of the Lord with them at that critical moment. And so we have in Hebrews the 13th chapter, verses 5 and 6. Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. For he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. So that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me. And so in verse 26 and 27, we find Nebuchadnezzar calls for the three Hebrews to come out of the furnace. And we find in verse 27 that when they examined the three Hebrews, there was no destruction from the fire. There was not even the smell of the smoke that was on their clothes or nothing of that sort. Their hair was not singed. Sister Kathy Migas was mentioning last night in our fellowship at Brother and Sister Carl's and Sister Marge, that how true it is when you're near a fire, whether it's a fire in the fireplace or maybe a barbecue, that your clothes kind of get that scent of the smoke and it's difficult to get rid of. But we find with the three Hebrews that they were miraculously preserved. What an incredible miracle. Reprint 2495 mentions that this miracle would have had a tremendous impact not just on King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, but as word spread amongst all the Hebrews who were captive in Babylon, they would have heard of this, the faith of these three Hebrews, and how God had miraculously saved them. And in this reprint article 2495, it mentions that why idolatry had been one of the chief sins of Israel in the ages past, that after this miracle, that idolatry was not one of their, didn't happen very often. It was very little occurred. And that must have been because of this miracle. It must have been retold to each generation. So what can we learn from the lives of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? I'm sure there's many lessons. Here are 7 points to get us started. Lesson number one, how parents are one of the most influential role models to their children. They were for the four Hebrews. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Lesson number two, the importance of choosing good friends. The three Hebrews chose good friends in each other and in Daniel also. It influenced these four to do good and to remain faithful to God. The four Hebrews studied together. They ate together. They lived in the same home at one time together. They prayed together. And for the three Hebrews, they were willing to die together. Lesson three, we should worry about what God thinks, about our words and our decisions and actions, and not what others may think. Even if we're in a minority, if we find ourselves in a situation where we're in the minority. The four Hebrews were just a small group compared to the other youths in Nebuchadnezzar's program. They were just the minority to not eat the king's food. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were just three individuals compared to the thousands. They were just three who didn't bow down to the golden image. Can you imagine? They would have been left standing there as they would look out and they would just see hundreds of thousands of people all bowed down. Lesson four. How we should always resist peer pressure that tries us to do anything we know that's not right. And that's particularly true for the young people in school, but also in the workplace and in the community. And oftentimes, these little character tests will pop up unexpectedly without any foreknowledge. And I'm sure that was the case with the three Hebrews. Lesson five, when we face a severe trial or test and are passing through the fire, so to speak, that we have to realize God's providences will vary. And in each situation, for each individual, they may have different outcomes. Some will have a remarkable deliverance for a time, and others will not. And in reprint 2496, it kind of points out this thought. That's where we got it from. And it says there, God intervened with the three Hebrews with the fiery furnace. But God did not prevent the beheading of John the Baptist, even though in Matthew 11:11 it says that there hath not arisen a greater prophet than John the Baptist. Another example in that reprint was the fact that Peter was delivered from prison by the angel of the Lord. James was not. He was beheaded. And the Apostle Paul's life was miraculously preserved on several occasions while Stephen was stoned. So we expect that we will have tests at some points in our life. And as Peter wrote in 1 Peter 4, verse 12 and 13, and this is from the NIV, Peter said to us, "Do not be surprised at the painful trial you're suffering, as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed." We have the lesson that we are to follow what is right, regardless of the consequences in today's world, and to trust in the Heavenly Father. Proverbs 3, verses 5 through 7, Proverbs 3, 5 through 7, in the NIV says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all our ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct our paths." And that we are to not be wise in our own eyes, but rather we should fear the Lord and shun evil. Lesson number 6 from the 3 Hebrews. Loyal characters do not grow suddenly overnight, but are normally the result of progressive growth. With the 3 Hebrews, the decision of self-denial of the king's food was another step in their character development, to have a strong character that loved righteousness. And the same with us. As we practice self-denials in the little things of life, we become stronger spiritually and are able to overcome with the Lord's help. Luke 16:10 says in the NIV, "Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much." And the 7th lesson, when we go through a fiery trial, we're not alone. The Lord is always with us, and he will not permit the new creature to be destroyed. As Job said in Job 23, verse 10, talking about the Heavenly Father, "But he knoweth the way that I take, and when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold." In conclusion, we'd like to quote some thoughts from reprint 2493. In 2493, it mentions that the character of the 3 Hebrews in many ways will correspond to the character that will be found in the church class. That in the church class, they will also have that same spirit of devotion to God, to love the principles of righteousness, and they will also be tested under God's providence. It's our prayer for each and every one of you, as Peter wrote to us in 1 Peter 1:7, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ.